Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Myesha Braden of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, who explains why her group has condemned the Trump Justice Department for rescinding critical legal guidance documents on important civil rights and other issues. Josh Hoxie of the Institute for Policy Studies, who summarizes his group's new report, which finds that America's top 25 billionaires have as much wealth as 56% of the U.S. population. And Noliwe Rooks, Director of American Studies at Cornell University, who talks about her new book titled Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
By mid-January, President Trump may have an opportunity to impose new sanctions on Iran that would derail the historic nuclear agreement signed by Iran, the U.S., European states, Russia, and China. Even as key members of Trump's national security team try to preserve the nuclear deal, Trump may opt to kill it. Last October, Trump refused to certify the agreement, citing Iran's actions in Syria and across the Middle East, which are not linked to the nuclear agreement. In recent days, the Trump administration has imposed new, largely symbolic sanctions against 25 Iranian companies and individuals, including the Quds Force of Iran's Revolutionary Guard. On January 11th, Trump faces another deadline to certify Iran's compliance with the nuclear deal. International inspectors report Iran continues to be in compliance with the agreement. But if Trump rejects the agreement, Congress has 60 days to reimpose sanctions. He can also decide not to renew a waiver that exempts Iran from sanctions. If he does so, Tehran will likely declare that the U.S. has breached the agreement and then could restart its nuclear program. Daryl Kimball, executive director of the Arms Control Association, worries that Trump's move to put the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem demonstrates his willingness to ignore the advice of his own national security team in favor of pleasing his right-wing political base. These decisions come at a sensitive moment for Iran, where thousands of protesters have taken to the streets to express their anger about a flagging economy, corruption, and rising fuel and food prices. United Nations child protection workers have been deployed to the border between Haiti and the Dominican Republic, looking for Haitian children who may be abandoned, trafficked, or separated from their families. The International Organization for Migration and Haiti's Child Welfare Agency operate a safe house run by a Catholic charity to temporarily house lost or abandoned children. According to the Miami Herald, thousands of children each year are trafficked in Haiti. Many fled abuse or were abandoned by their parents. In the safe house, children wait for parents to claim them. Otherwise, they are sent to live in an orphanage. Efforts to protect vulnerable children in Haiti were increased after a group of American missionaries were accused of kidnapping 33 children and attempting to take them out of the country in the aftermath of the deadly 2010 earthquake. Despite recent advancements in child protection, hundreds of thousands of children are exploited as domestic servants, with a significant number fleeing employers' homes or abusive families. Investors in private prisons were the big winners in the new Republican tax cut legislation that slashed tax rates for the wealthy and big corporations. At the same time, key middle-class benefits such as deductions for state and local taxes were scaled back. Under the new tax law signed by President Trump, real estate investment trusts, or REITs, will see a 25% tax cut. Two of the largest private prison companies, CoreCivic, which is formerly Corrections Corporation of America, and Geo Group, restructured as REITs in 2013. The two corporations operate over 80% of the private prison beds in the U.S. The Guardian newspaper reports that Geo Group and CoreCivic paid out over $430 million in dividends to investors in 2017, but with the new tax law, they could pay out an additional $50 million to stockholders. According to Lauren Brooke Eisen of the Brennan Center for Justice, prison companies have argued that renting out cells to the government is the equivalent of charging a tenant rent. The GEO Group donated $500,000 to Trump's inauguration committee and booked its annual meeting at a Trump resort in Miami. Soon thereafter, the company secured a lucrative government contract for an immigration detention center. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Toward the end of the Obama administration, the Justice Department issued 25 guidance documents to prosecutors, judges, and others involved in the criminal justice system to improve the administration of laws, including civil rights laws. Based on interpretations of the Constitution and legal precedent, the guidelines were put into practice in places like Ferguson, Missouri, New Orleans, Louisiana, and the states of Arkansas, Tennessee, and Alabama, in order to redress injustices such as criminalizing people who owe civil fines. On December 22nd, President Trump's Attorney General Jeff Sessions withdrew these guidance documents, charging that they were creating new law and evading regulatory process. The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law condemned Sessions' action, with the group's president and executive director Kristen Clark writing, quote, "We condemn Attorney General Sessions' latest attempt to turn back the clock on civil rights progress and urge courts and administrators across the country to take affirmative steps to halt the resurgence of unconstitutional debtors' prisons in their communities." Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Maisha Braden, director of the Criminal Justice Project with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, which was founded at the request of President John F. Kennedy and his brother, then Attorney General Robert Kennedy, to provide lawyers to those advocating for civil rights and the indigent. Here, Braden, who left the Justice Department after 15 years, explains why she believes that Sessions' Justice Department abdication of its responsibility creates a danger for all Americans.
I can speak specifically to the guidance that was revoked that related to criminal justice fines and fees. There were 25, some of them relate to civil rights, some of them don't. The fines and fees guidance sits squarely at the heart of our civil rights work and involves the 14th Amendment and the rights that people are entitled to, due process and equal protection under the 14th Amendment. This guidance resulted following the Department of Justice's very detailed investigation into what was happening in Ferguson, Missouri. In the Ferguson investigation, the Department of Justice found that that municipality was using fines and fees not as a method of increasing or promoting public safety, but as a method of collecting revenue. People were being fined for things like jaywalking and expired tags and different really relatively minor misdemeanor offenses, and they were receiving substantial fines and fees that compounded as the payments were late. As a result of that, people were simply walking around Ferguson with warrants all over the place, and those warrants had a negative effect on those people's experience of citizenship. It had a negative effect on their employment opportunities, sometimes housing opportunities. And based on that report and what was found in that report, the Department of Justice issued guidance so that courts would understand, under a case called Bearden v. Georgia, the Supreme Court had found that the 14th Amendment prohibited the jailing of individuals without a consideration of their ability to pay debt. That's it. That's all the guidance did. It set out very clearly that the courts could not send people to jail for non-payment of fines and fees unless the courts had first found that that non-payment was willful. As a result of the Department of Justice's guidance letter, courts and municipalities in many places started to make changes, some of their own accord, some as a result of litigation that was brought and some as a result of legislators understanding that there was a problem with fines and fees and trying to make changes within their states, and city council people trying to make changes within their cities. Department of Justice is responsible for establishing justice and promoting practices that ensure justice, fairness, and equality for all Americans. So this guidance document and the similar guidance documents that were revoked were simply the Justice Department implementing its full mission. To watch Attorney General Sessions roll back those things suggests that the Justice Department is operating at less than its full capacity, that the Justice Department is not interested in promoting justice, particularly as it relates to civil rights issues. And that can be seen, in addition to the pulling back of these guidance documents, to Attorney General Sessions' statements concerning consent decrees, how he disfavored them and intended to perhaps not use them at all, in addition to reversing positions on the use or the providing of military equipment to law enforcement, to suggesting that the Justice Department was not interested in looking at police misconduct and excessive use of force because of concerns about low morale for police officers, and just avoiding all of the proof, all of the evidence, all of the data suggesting that those incidents of violence actually undermine the ability of law enforcement to do their job because it causes them to lose the trust of the communities that they're assigned to protect. Now, without this guidance from the Department of Justice and without the support of the Department of Justice for making these changes, it will be much harder to get jurisdictions to make changes of their own accord. And perhaps only litigation will be able to force that change. The power of a DOJ statement on the legality of a practice really cannot be understated.
Maisha Braden, is there anything that can be done to reverse this?
No, because it was a guidance document. The Attorney General has the prerogative to issue or not issue, to pull back or not. I wish they were being much more thoughtful rather than simply what appears to be rolling back everything that Attorney General Holder and President Obama did simply because they did it.
That was Maisha Braden, Director of the Criminal Justice Project with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Learn more about the project and challenges to the Justice Department's action on civil rights issues by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. America has for many decades witnessed a steady rise in wealth inequality as incomes of the rich skyrocket and that of middle class and poor families have stagnated. While the United States is one of the richest countries in the world, it's also one of the most unequal. According to a report published by the World Economic Forum in 2017, the U.S. ranks 23 out of 30 developed nations in a measure known as the Inclusive Development Index, which factors in data on income, health, poverty, and sustainability. The unpopular new Republican tax reform legislation, recently signed into law by President Trump, will, according to many economists, exacerbate inequality further, with reductions in tax rates for wealthy individuals and corporations. At the same time, cuts are made to critical social programs millions of Americans rely on. A recently published report titled Billionaire Bonanza 2017, The Forbes 400 and the Rest of Us, exposes the extreme wealth concentrated within the fortunes of the 400 wealthiest Americans and compares this wealth to the much more meager assets of several different segments of U.S. society. Your reporter spoke with Josh Hoxie, director of the Institute for Policy Studies Project on Opportunity and Taxation, who summarizes some of the important findings in this report that he co-authored with Chuck Collins.
This report looks at the Forbes 400, which Forbes magazine's been producing for a little over 30 years, their list of the 400 richest people, which is the best guess we have at how much money is really concentrated at the very tippity top of the economic spectrum. And I say best guess because there's so much money hiding in offshore tax shelters, as recently has come to light, that this is as much as we'll know. So these numbers are almost certainly worse than we have depicted here. And it compares those numbers to a survey the Federal Reserve puts out every 3 years called the Survey of Consumer Finances, which is a statistically representative picture of Americans' wealth and income and things of that nature. The report compares these two groups, and our findings are pretty bleak, and they've sort of been getting worse year after year, as this is the second time we've sort of done this. We did it last in 2015. So, you know, the full Forbes 400 list own as much as the bottom 64% of the U.S. population, which, to put that in context, 400 people in the United States have as much wealth as the entire GDP of Great Britain, which is an insane amount of money. Part of the disparity in the United States is that while there's so much wealth concentrating at the top, many, many people at the bottom are struggling. So we looked into what we're calling underwater nation, which is the population of people who are either at zero net worth or negative net worth, meaning they owe more money than they own in assets. And about 1 in 5 Americans fits into that category. Those numbers are deeply skewed by racial numbers. The proportion of Black and Latino families who are underwater is about double the proportion that white families are underwater as a result of, you know, decades of discrimination.
Josh, in this report, you talk about hereditary aristocracy of wealth and power that is now firmly in place in the United States. Tell us a little bit about the unfair economic policies that have played a role in rising income inequality that many conservative political activists ascribe to some kind of supernatural phenomenon or random set of outcomes. But there is a policy link to things that are decided in Washington, right?
Absolutely. And a lot of folks in this country who have done very well economically want to believe that they did it on their own. We have a recurring myth in this country of, you know, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. And for a population of people, that's true, born into poverty and became rich. However, the United States has increasingly decreasing, which is a funny way to say it, more and more folks are struggling to get out of poverty. And the best indicator for how well you're going to do financially is how well your parents did financially. So on the one hand, like, sure, people do work hard and get ahead. On the other hand, plenty of people work just as hard and don't get ahead because of the lottery of their birth. So when we talk about inherited advantage, we're talking about that birth lottery, which is to say, you know, one example, how hard did Tiffany Trump work to become the wealthy heiress that she is, or Paris Hilton for that matter? And that's not to begrudge them their status. It's just to say that, you know, as far as the tax code is concerned, I just can't understand why we'd want to charge people taxes who punch a paycheck every week and not charge taxes to people who all they had to do was wait for their money because they won it in a genetic lottery. I mean, even lottery findings are taxed, so why wouldn't we tax the genetic lottery? It's sort of absurd if you think about it in those terms.
In line with other economists around the world, you observed that the levels of inequality that we see that are only skyrocketing are unsustainable both economically and politically. I wondered if you'd explain.
I think folks should really get a sense that this is not normal. I mean, what we're seeing right now of the concentration of wealth at the top has only really happened in the lead up to other not great things. I mean, the first Gilded Age led up to the Great Depression. We don't really want to see that again. So the breakup of wealth is going to happen one way or another. I hope it doesn't happen by war and depressions and things of that nature. There's a much less violent and more pleasant way to do it, to break up wealth, and it's pretty straightforward, taxing the rich and investing in economic opportunity for everyone in the country. But to your point, yeah, like we can't continue like this. I mean, there's only so much folks will accept, and as more wealth hides in offshore tax shelters, any semblance of truth to the idea that wealth is going to trickle down from the top just goes away. I mean, it's just not true. So instead, they find ways to buy, you know, a 10-foot longer yacht. I mean, really, what's the difference between a 190-foot yacht and a 197-foot yacht? But that's honestly the level of where our money is going in terms of how the very, very wealthy are spending their assets when they're not just watching it move up higher and higher on a computer screen.
That was Josh Hoxie, director of the Institute for Policy Studies Project on Opportunity and Taxation, and co-author, along with Chuck Collins, of the report titled Billionaire Bonanza 2017, The Forbes 400 and the Rest of Us. Find a link to the report and related analysis and commentary on rising inequality in the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Randy Weingarten, who leads the 1.6 million member American Federation of Teachers Union, declared in August that President Trump's education secretary, Betsy DeVos, is the most ideological anti-public education person to ever be nominated or confirmed to that position. DeVos, who never attended public school or worked in one, has devoted her life to allowing parents to choose the schools their children attend, either charter or private schools using public funds, in decreasing the federal government's role in education. DeVos bankrolled a ballot measure in Michigan to create a public school voucher system that was soundly defeated by a 2-to-1 margin. She then spent millions of dollars of her own money to elect legislators who then made deep cuts to public school budgets and promoted unaccountable for-profit charter schools in the state. Now almost half of Michigan's charter schools rank near the bottom, and Michigan dropped from 28th to 41st in reading skills and from 27th to 42nd in math compared with other states. Your reporter spoke with No Leeway Rooks, director of American Studies at Cornell University, who talks about her new book titled Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. Here, Professor Rooks condemns school privatization efforts and contends that publicly funded schools are essential to quality, equal education for all, and an indispensable element to build a democratic society.
Taxpayer-supported public education starts for the entire country. It had been in certain parts of the East Coast, in Massachusetts in particular, from the 1600s. But it's really post-Reconstruction that the rest of the country gets with the idea of, we should use taxpayer dollars to educate all of our citizens, regardless of wealth. Before 1890 to 1920, that period, education was really something only for the very wealthy. It was mostly private. People were sent to Europe. They were sent to private boarding schools in the U.S. And the idea of educating the masses of Americans really is a kind of quintessentially American intervention, that no matter who you are, no matter your social station, there's something about education that would be valuable for you. And this is a way that we can start to educate all Americans around what citizenship means, that we can define a particular kind of civic imagination and a goal of democracy, of what kinds of citizens we want to participate in this experiment in democracy where, voters, where everyone, where citizens of the country are engaging in setting the policy and setting the direction. That was the ideal.
When we see the drive toward privatizing our education system in this country through charter schools, the movement towards school vouchers, the whole notion of school choice, which underlines those, and a system called virtual education, tell us a bit about how that affects the quality of education. These companies obviously are in it to make a buck. They're making profit here by getting into privatizing the education system. But what's the effect on the students?
So one of the terms that I came up with to talk about this moment, where we really do have an unprecedented move toward dismantling what we consider traditional public education, what that's being replaced by with high concentrations of poor people and high concentrations of people of color are charter schools, which are publicly financed but privately run. So they're not beholden to the same kinds of oversight and regulation as traditional public schools. But they depend on taxpayer dollars, or there's an offshoot of the homeschooling movement for virtual charter schools. These are schools where children as young as 5 years old can get the entirety of their education through computers. They're rarely having contact with other students, rarely having contact with teachers, and it costs school districts almost the same amount as a brick-and-mortar school. Or you'll have something like these alternatively certified teachers like Teach for America and other entities like that, which charge often struggling school districts between $2,000 to $5,000 per teacher that they supply as a kind of finder's fee. The thing about all of this is it's supposed to address the underachievement of children of color, low test scores, low graduation rates, the persistent problems that we see in certain kinds of communities. But the solutions that we've come up with are undoubtedly, like we're clear, making certain businesses very, very wealthy. Teach for America, which I mentioned, supplies teachers to these kinds of districts. The last I looked in 2016, it's been about a year, but they were worth almost $400 million. Wealthy children, upper middle class children, do not go to schools where their teachers are overwhelmingly trained with 5 weeks of training in the summer and put in classes. There'd be a complete uprising if you went into an upper middle class neighborhood or a wealthy neighborhood or a private school and touted the fact that the majority of our teachers have only had 5 weeks of training. So the question that I started to ask is, but why are the forms of education, the ways, the methods, the thinking about education so very different depending on the race and class of the children we're talking about educating? And there's something about that that started to feel fundamentally wrong to me.
That was Noliwe Rooks, Director of American Studies at Cornell University, and author of the new book titled Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. For more discussion of the issues raised in Rook's book, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WREK in Atlanta, Georgia, KKFI in Kansas City, Missouri, Free Radio in Santa Cruz, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.